Okay, so to start, so today we are going to look at the sutta which is called Removing Resentment, or if you like, Removing Ill Will and Anger and all these kind of things. So far we have been looking at more general ideas, how the path functions in general. And what we are working on right now is the idea of right effort, right? How to use right effort to overcome specifically the defilements in the mind. That's what we're actually working on now. And we're going to be looking at that for quite a while. Of all these defilements in the mind, usually the two main defilements we talk about are ill will and sensual desire. These are the two main things that we can deal with. There's also sometimes we talk about delusion as well. But delusion is more difficult to do anything about. The first thing to do to work with is always the ill will and the desire. And then the delusion sort of comes along as part of that process of removing ill will and desire. And of all these defilements, the most destructive one and the one which causes the most suffering and problems both for ourselves and also for others is obviously is ill will, right? Anger and this sort of thing. It's very, very destructive emotions, and I think a lot of the problems in the world are due to this particular emotion. So because of that, this should always be given priority. Of all the things that we should look at, this is the one that we should work with more than anything else to overcome. And it's true that there is a connection between craving and ill will, but there's also a separation there. So it's possible to deal with one without necessarily dealing too much with the other. The other thing about this is that there is a continuum here between dealing with ill will and then moving on to metta. Metta and removing ill will are just two sides of the same coin, right? You're removing ill will, you practice metta, and the kind of two things go together. So this is just two sides of the same coin. So what we're really talking about here is really how to, this is the start point for how to develop the metta, the loving kindness, in both meditation and also in our daily lives. Right? Okay, so removing resentment, removing ill will. So this sutta is spoken by Venerable Sariputta. And it goes as follows. So there, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Friend, those bhikkhus replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen toward anyone. What five? Here, a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So that is the summary of this sutta. These suttas are often a kind of set out in a very sort of pedagogical fashion, right? They start with a summary at the beginning, then you have the main text, and sometimes you have a summary at the end again. So the Buddha was like a great teacher. He knew how to kind of get the message across. The point here, you have these five categories of people. The point here is that these five categories, they include everybody. Everybody is part of this, right? So there is what that means, there's no excuse for having ill will against anyone. That's what it means. There's always a way of dealing with ill will, regardless where it is. And that is actually quite nice, isn't it? That there is this way of dealing with ill will in all kinds of circumstances. So this is a particular way of dividing up. And the reason why it is divided up in this way is because the way we deal with people is slightly different depending on what they are like, depending on the circumstances. So this is why we have this kind of division here. But everyone is included, right? So you cannot say, I exclude this particular person because you find them very difficult. There's always a way of dealing with them as well. So let's say what the Buddha has to, Venerable Sariputta has to say about this. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed bhikkhu seeing a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion one should attend, and one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Right? So it's simple, right? It's very simple. It is the acknowledgement that a lot of people in our lives, they have many different aspects of their personality. They have some good aspects, some bad aspects, neutral aspects, all kinds of things. And part of the development of the loving kindness is always the focusing on the good aspect in somebody else instead of focusing on the bad ones. Sometimes people say, that's denial of reality, you're denying the truth, you think people are complex and all these kind of things. But the reality is that there isn't really any reality, right? You have a person and one person likes them, another person dislikes them. So who is right? Is that person like one or is it like the other person thinks it is? And it's really, the point is that it's all about our perception of other people, and our perception is always going to be uncertain. So instead of asking the question, you know, we should focus on reality, which is always changing anyway, we should instead focus on those things that actually lead towards a growth on the Buddhist path. That's what we should focus on, and that is what matters. So instead of saying, I want to see this person as they actually are, the way they actually are is a very profound thing anyway, right? It's something maybe a Buddha will be able to see beings as they actually are. And the Buddha, of course, he has complete compassion, right? So if we have anger, it means that we're probably not seeing things as they actually are. We're probably missing out something. We don't really understand what's going on. For that reason, we just choose to look at those qualities that are helpful for spiritual growth. That's what we choose to look at. And by doing that, we are moving in the right direction. There is no absolute truth underlying these things. And for that reason, it is perfectly okay to choose those things. And this is what you will find. You will find that there, you know, people, generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, it's quite easy to see both the negative and the good sides. Particularly people who are close to us, people like family members, right? On the one hand, you love them. On the other hand, they also irritate you. You know, it's this kind of this dual thing with people who are close to us. That's how it tends to be. So you learn to focus on the good side, and you think, wow. Isn't it amazing that they actually have all these good sides? Isn't that what is really amazing here? In a world which often is difficult, with all kind of problems, of course they're going to have some bad sides. Forget about that. What is amazing is that they have the good sides. And you focus on that, and you kind of appreciate that, and you feel a sense of gratitude that people have beautiful sides to them. This is how we do this. And as we saw many things on the Buddhist path, to be able to do this, you need to train yourself, right? You need to think, you need to actually reflect on these good qualities. It's not enough just to use this thing as, you can't just sit down and then change your perception just like that. You have to actually reflect, what are the good qualities in these people? And isn't it really marvelous that they have these qualities? And the more you build up that perception of that good side in somebody else, wow, they're keeping the 8 precepts, right? What does it matter if they do some tiny little thing every now and again? They may not even mean it. They may be completely oblivious to what is going on. Why am I focusing on this stupid little fault when they are, you know, when actually underneath it there's something so powerful and so beautiful? Isn't that what I should be focusing on? And it's so obvious when you think about that is what we should be focusing on, because that is really what is the kind of the thing which really matters in that person. That is the essence, that's what they're trying to be. That is their intention. That is what they are, kind of what really is important in that person. So this is the problem in life. We tend to get drawn away from the things that really matter into this small little area. So you have to build up that perception and think, wow, so many good qualities, what a wonderful thing that is. And then you can go back. And then when you have built up that perception, it's like you have an arsenal inside of yourself, kind of the arsenal of loving kindness, right? And as soon as the ill will comes up, you bring out that arsenal and you apply it in that situation. So it's like you have this powerful tool inside of you, which you can apply in these kind of situations. But like all tools, they have to be built up. It takes effort, it takes work to be able to do these things. Okay, so let's have a look at this nice little simile here. Suppose a rag-robed bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. So a rag-robed bhikkhu, or maybe a rag-robed bhikkhuni, right? This is the one of the practices that is talked about in the suttas, that you can wear different types of robes, and some of the monks and I think nuns probably as well in those days, they would just collect rags, right? And then they would sew together a robe from all the rags they would collect. And sometimes they would go to the charnel grounds, right, where the corpses were thrown aside, and they would kind of take the cloth from the corpse before the corpse kind of was starting to decompose too much. If it decomposes too much, then the cloth becomes very, very terrible. But before it's too decomposed, you take the cloth and you use that for your robe. And actually, there's a nice little story. I can tell. This is a story in the... it's nice to have a little bit of story. This is a story from the monk's Vinaya. The Vinaya is like the rules are laid down for the monastics. And this is a story which goes with the Parajika number 2. The Parajika number 2 is about stealing. If you steal as a monk or a nun above a certain value, you are automatically expelled from the monastic community because you don't really have the qualities that it takes to be a monastic. And this story is a story of someone who goes, a monk who goes to the charnel ground, and he then takes, he sees this corpse, this kind of fairly fresh corpse, right? And he takes the cloth. But the problem is that the corpse is a little bit too fresh. So as he walks away, the corpse rises up and starts walking behind him. This is a story from the Vinaya. You can see kind of where some of these horror stories come from, right? They kind of go back to very ancient times. The corpse rises up and follows him back to his cutie, and the monk kind of walks faster and faster, looking back, seeing this corpse coming behind him. You are taking my cloth, right? You're taking my robe. And then eventually he comes back to his cutie and he slams the door, and then the corpse kind of collapses on the outside. And so that is actually a story from the monastic Vinaya, kind of the original, some of the original horror stories you see there. And kind of the zombies, the revenge of the zombies or something. And the point of that story is just that then, you know, the bhikkhu goes to the Buddha and says, oh, I'm a bit worried. Did I steal anything? Did I steal from that corpse? And then the Buddha says, no, it's okay, you didn't steal because, you know, you thought it was dead or whatever. But in the future, you should wait till the corpse is cold before you take the cloth. These are kind of the stories you see in the monastic rules. It's quite interesting sometimes. Anyways, that was what the monastics were up to in those days. You take the cloth and you sew together a robe, right? And you would have a rag robe. And of course, it's very nice, right? Sometimes you will see monastics, just like everybody, they get into kind of fashions almost. You have to have a robe of a certain quality or a certain type. But that is not what monastic life is about. It's about the exact opposite. Sometimes if you have a rag robe, it can be quite good, right? You can't have much desire for that sort of robe. Unless you want to make an impression on people that you're very ascetic, perhaps. As always, there can be defilements everywhere, right? It's the why you do things that matters, and you have to always know your own mind. So anyway, you have these rag robe wearing monks, and so what you do then, when you find a rag by the roadside, you press it down with the left foot, and you spread it out with the right foot. So you want to see the rag, right? Which parts of the rag are worthy of keeping? Which ones are bad? So you spread it out and you have a look at it. And you do the same thing with the person. You look at the whole person and you kind of pick out those parts in the person that are worthy of keeping. And then you have the parts of the person that are not worthy of keeping, right? The bad parts. So it's a simile of looking at the whole thing. And then once you see the cloth, you spread it out. You tear off all the rubbish, right? All the bad part, all the stuff which is rotten or which smells or is stinky, you tear that off. And once that is torn off, you take the intact part and you take it with you and you carry it with you. And it's the same thing with people. You look at the whole person and then you see all the bad, all the things that you don't like, and you say, I don't have anything to do with that. I don't even know if it's true. And people are very complex. You take all that rubbish that you're seeing, right? It was just rubbish. And you throw it out, and you take all the good qualities and you carry those with you. The same idea, right? It's a beautiful idea, this idea of carrying all the good qualities of other people. That's what you carry in your heart. And you carry this with you as you go away. That's what you take with you. It's a wonderful image. It's the image of, and this is what we then try to deal with people. We carry only the good stuff with us. The rest is rubbish. It's just useless. It's not going to get us anywhere. It's just going to block us from meditation, block us from being kind, block us from being good people. So it is useless. So that is the simile there of how to deal with these qualities. But again, you have to build these perceptions up, right? And when these perceptions become strong, that is when they start to work. But it works, and this is the amazing thing. It really, this sort of stuff really, really works. It's a very powerful technique of dealing with these things. Okay, so that is the first person. Let's move on to the second person. And how, friends, should resentment... Actually, before I do that, I should also perhaps say that this kind of technique can be used in many parts of one's life, in one's spiritual life. It is used in daily life, right? When you hang around with people, you shift your attention if there is a problem. But it's also used in meditation practice. You sit down, you meditate, and then you shift your attention if the wrong kind of thought come up in the mind. This is very useful. It's universally useful way of dealing with problems. Okay, so let's go on to the second person. So how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So this is just the point here. I think it's simply that people, first of all, the point is that people have different aspects, right? Some people have good aspects here, other people have good personality traits there. So you have to kind of be flexible with these things. And sometimes a person changes. Sometimes a person may actually change over time. So then you have to be flexible again with how you look at that particular person. It's very similar to the previous one. But what is nice here is this simile here, I think is very nice. And this is the idea of a person who is afflicted, right? You're oppressed by the heat. You are weary, you're tired, and you're thirsty. And this idea of being oppressed by the heat, this is like the idea of the fire of anger inside, the fire of ill will. It makes you feel oppressed inside by these defilements that you have. Sometimes we think, I choose things, but actually it's an oppression. It is something that we're not able to get away from. So we want to find a way to get rid of this oppression inside of us. And of course, the beautiful thing is that you, when you are oppressed like that, when you are really heated or whatever, you find a nice pond, you plunge into the pond, right? You sweep away the algae and the water plants. This is like perhaps the bad qualities in the person. And then you drink from the water, right? You drink from the beautiful qualities in that person. And when you drink from the beautiful qualities of a person, then of course the oppression of anger, of resentment, that is removed, right? So you drink that, take it on board, and then you feel good afterwards. So it's a nice idea there of how, you know, what it means to take to change, and all we're doing here is we're just, you know, changing your attention, changing your perception, moving it from one area and moving it on to something else. And maybe one thing I should mention here as well, this is very similar to, again, I mentioned the other day a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, which perhaps I should have brought out for this retreat as well. And this is the sutta on the calming of unwholesome thoughts, Majjhima Nikaya number 20. It's a very nice little sutta. And the first way of calming the unwholesome thoughts mentioned, there's five ways mentioned. And the first one mentioned is the idea of substitution. So you substitute, you see a defilement arise in the mind, you see anger is about to come, but before it is able to arise, once it's established itself too much, it's very hard to dislodge a defilement. But if you're able to get hold of it at the very early stage, all you do is you swap the thinking, right? It's like it's called a substitution of thought. And sometimes you wonder, how do you do that? And this sutta here is really the answer to how you do that. You have built up this store inside of you, this ability to see the good qualities in somebody. And because you have that storehouse of perceptions ready to be kind of pulled out at the right time, you just swap over to that other perception, which is already available inside of you. You swap over to that, and that is how the substitution happens. And this is what we're doing here. We're moving the attention from one area to another one. So try this in your own life. It is not that difficult to do. The Buddha says elsewhere in the sutta that anger or ill will is something that is relatively easy to overcome. And this is one of the powerful ways of overcoming it. Okay, let's move on to the next one. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle, then a person might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. On that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind he gains from time to time. In this right way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Right? So this is a person who, you know, basically a lot of his behavior is not so good, right? Bodily behavior not so good, verbal behavior not so good. But he gains, it says here, from time to time, an opening of the mind. An opening, the word in Pali is vivadana, is the opposite of nivadana. Nivadana is the hindrances, right? You know, the five hindrances that we often talk about in Buddhism. Five hindrances to peace, to meditation. Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. So this is the opposite. It's the vivarana. It's when the mind is released from those hindrances, and you feel a sense of peace, and you feel a sense of ease because it's released from that. That's what placidity of the mind means. The mind is very even, very placid, very calm. There's very little ruffles in the mind. There's not much restlessness there, right? There's no agitation, and not much tiredness. It's very even, peaceful, and beautiful. You focus on that. How do you know that people sometimes have these states? Well, we know that because we observe people. And it's amazing how much you can read of a person's mind by just observing them, right? If you observe people properly, you can actually know what their mind is like. Sometimes it is one of those interesting things in the suttas. They talk about mind reading, and we think, wow, mind reading, that's amazing. But the suttas actually say that the basic mind reading is just observing somebody, right? You observe their behavior, and you have a rough idea what's going on in their heads. You observe their behavior, okay, you know they're angry. You observe their behavior, you know they're restless. And it's not that difficult to do. And we can all do that to some extent. And this is actually the Buddha's own explanation for the basic way of reading somebody's mind. So we know generally what's going on, to some extent at least, we know what's going on in other people's heads. So this is how you can do that. And the simile here, of course, is that because it is such a narrow little area, you have to be very careful. So you have to be very careful, you don't stir up. You have this chance, there is this water there, and you know that if you drink from that water, then you will feel cooled down. Your oppression, your ill will be cooled by that little water. But it's only a tiny amount of water, right? Only a tiny amount of good qualities. So you have to be very careful. If you look a little bit too much to one side or the other side, you're going to see something you don't like, and then the ill will will come back. So you have to focus down very narrowly. But the point is that that can be done. This is really what this is saying. It is possible to focus very narrowly on even small aspects of good qualities. And so you act like the cow. You're very, very careful. You know, you bend down and you suck up the water without stirring it up. And then you have this effect of calming and relieving the heat and the oppression of the ill will and the anger inside. So you can see here that there's a very strong emphasis here on looking at the good qualities, right? The next one is about using compassion. But so far, very strong emphasis on looking at the good qualities in people, not being too quick to move towards compassion and thinking, feeling a sense of compassion for the person, but always trying first of all to see the good qualities in somebody else. So why is that? Why do we have this kind of, why is it such a big emphasis on that? And this is another thing you will see in the suttas, the way the Buddha speaks. He always, when he talks about the Brahma Viharas, the four divine abidings, it always starts with loving kindness, with metta, first of all. Metta is always first. Then comes compassion, karuna. Karuna is number two. Then you have pamuja, the sympathetic joy, and then you have upekkha, the equanimity or even-mindedness is the last one, right? Mudita is the third one. And that sequence is invariable, it's always like that. And again, as I always say, when the suttas have a sequence in a certain way, there's a certain thing which is kind of invariable like that, there's a reason for that, it's not random. There's a reason why metta comes before karuna. It's not just, because, you have to have a certain order. Almost everything in Buddhism has a purpose to it. Remember what we said on the very first day, phrasing and meaning. Phrasing is so important on the Buddhist path. So why is that? And the reason is that if you look at the good qualities in somebody, there's very little danger of going wrong, right? When you see the beauty in somebody else, when you see the good qualities, only good things can come from that. It's very difficult for that to go astray and go in the wrong way. It will almost always make you happy and make the other person happy. Compassion, on the other hand, is a bit more difficult because compassion is about seeing the suffering in somebody else, seeing the problem, and then you have compassion because you see the problem. And sometimes if you emphasize too much the idea of seeing the suffering in other people and then having compassion, sometimes it can very easily turn into negativity and feeling the world is a difficult and hopeless place and all these kind of things, right? So you have to be very careful with the compassion. Compassion is more difficult to develop in the right way than loving kindness and metta. Metta is more basic, it's more powerful, it's more easy, and it's easy not to go wrong with metta than with compassion. And this is why we should always try to see the good qualities first. And this is why you have this very strong emphasis on looking at the good in other people before we move on to some other technique afterwards. Anyway, that's the way I look at this, and that's why I think that metta comes first, and why it is emphasized so much. And even if that is just my interpretation, it's still the case that metta is always placed first. So obviously, it is more basic. So there you are. And I know that many people find that compassion is more difficult precisely because you are focusing on the suffering more than you are with metta. Anyway, so that is the person who has this little bit of purity left, but not much. And then we come to the fourth person. And the fourth person, that is where we have to change tactics altogether, because now we can't see anything good in this fourth person. So how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure and who does not gain an opening of the mind, a placidity of the mind from time to time? Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter calamity and disaster right here." So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior." For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, he will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, or even in hell. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. And this is it's a beautiful way of thinking about someone you really find it hard to get along with, right? You cannot see anything good in them. All you see is bad qualities. There's nothing there to really look at. But instead of getting upset with that, instead of getting upset with the people in life that give you a really hard time and you can't see anything good with them, you regard them as ill, right? They are deluded. They are acting in their own worst interest. They're acting for their own suffering. Anyone who is acting to produce suffering for themselves in the future, you have to feel a bit sorry for them, right? They are basically doing things which an enemy would do to them. An enemy wants to kill you. And here they're acting as their own enemy, essentially. And then what can you do? There is delusion there. There's misunderstanding. You don't understand what you're doing. And then you see them as an ill person. They are sick. They're afflicted. There's something very wrong with them. And you think, "Oh, I hope they're able to understand that they're just destroying their own life. They're destroying their own future. They are on the way towards tremendous suffering if they continue in this way." It's a wonderful way of being able to look at people where it's hard to see the goodness and hard to see the good qualities. And then you can turn it around. You can turn around, instead of seeing the negative, instead of having that ill will towards a person, you turn it around into a positive perception instead. And it is something which is sustaining for your own practice. And of course, it often works as well, right? If you show a compassion to people like that in a kind of reasonable way, if you're able to be kind to somebody who is very difficult to you in return, often you will be like a mirror for that person, right? It will be like they will suddenly start to see, "Wait a minute, maybe I'm making a mistake here." As long as you are aggressive in return, or you are not showing kindness in return, or you are being defensive and all these kind of things, it is very hard for them to reflect on themselves, because all they will see is, they are just being bad towards me, so I can be bad or whatever. But if you are kind to somebody who is not kind to you, then very often they will start reflecting on themselves. You become like, they say, a mirror, right? and they start seeing themselves in a new way. And that is the power of kindness, the power of compassion, the power of sympathy here, that it actually, you are actually giving other people the chance and the opportunity to change. Okay, so that is the real scallywag out of the way. So now we can go to the opposite. Now we go from the scallywag to the saint. So the last one is the saintly person. So how, friends, should resentment be removed towards a person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure and from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks and a delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink. Then after coming out, he would sit or lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, the placidity of mind, on that occasion, one should attend to the pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. So this is the person who has all these good qualities, right? And then we still get angry with them. We still get ill will towards them. That's sometimes the problem. And you see in the suttas, people will get angry with the Buddha and all these kind of things. It will happen all the time. Not all the time, happened occasionally, I should say. But this is the sort of person where if you have a little bit of wisdom, it's very easy to get rid of that anger, right? Or that bad perception in your mind, because there's so much goodness to look at, so much goodness to see. So because of that, it's like plunging into this pond. You are afflicted by the heat, you're angry. You plunge into the pond, right? And then you bathe, and then you drink. And then when you come out, you can even lie down in the shade of the trees. There's so much to see there, so much to soothe that anger in your mind. So this is how you deal with that. So you don't feel too bad about yourself. Even if you get upset with somebody who you respect sometimes or who you think is a wonderful person, it's okay. These things happen. This is just life. But then you change your perception. You move it in a different direction. And you remind yourself that actually the main picture is just so beautiful. There's so much wonderful going on there. Why am I focusing on these little things? There's always going to be little things there. That's just life. Let me focus on the big picture. So that is how we deal with this thing. And it's a wonderful thing which in the suttas, this thing where the Buddha says that even an arahant, right? An arahant is the fully awakened person, the one who has abandoned all defilements of the mind. And the Buddha says even seeing an arahant in the world, even seeing such a person is an incredible blessing for people. Let alone when they speak the Dhamma and they speak the teachings, but just seeing them is so powerful. Why is that? And it's for this reason, right? You see the beautiful conduct. You see that there is no defilement. You see that there's only kindness. There's only patience. There's kind of a self-effacement. There's no ego. There's none of these things. It's just a very different type of person that we're used to seeing. And sometimes you have to look to see the arahant, right? The arahant is a person who kind of just sits in the corner and doesn't really say anything until they ask. Okay, then they might come forth and they might say something. It's a very different type of person from what they're used to seeing in the world. But when we recognize that, when we recognize those qualities, we think, wow, that is so powerful. There's something very special there. I remember this is again in Ajahn Brahm's book, one of his books, The Art of Disappearing, where he talks. I did most of the editing of that book, so I know it quite well. And towards the end of that book, Ajahn Brahm recalls this story when he went to see a monk in Thailand known as Ajahn Tate. And Ajahn Tate was very famous in those days, and he was famous for being a very special monk. And because he was so famous, the king of Thailand had this big palace for him. Not really palace, but this big hall, right? Which was very decorated and very ornate. I don't know if you have seen some of these Thai temples. They're very ornate and very beautiful temples that you can find in Thailand. So he had one of these things, known as a mandapa. And so Ajahn Brahm went there to pay respect to this monk who was so famous. And he said that when he came into that hall, Ajahn Tate was kind of sitting in the corner somewhere on a chair, right? And it was like when he walked into the room, it was like nobody was there. It was like it was completely empty, right? This monk was just so unobtrusive, so kind of, he had so disappeared so completely that it was as if the room was empty. And then you walk in, and when you walk into a room like that, it's like you feel this complete sense of acceptance, right? This complete sense of lack of no fear, no sense of any danger whatsoever. And all your defenses just disappear for the first time because you feel so relaxed. It's a very beautiful thing that happens. Ajahn Brahm said that he went there, he had all these questions, right? He was going to ask this monk. But as soon as you walk into that room, because you kind of, everything disappears, your mind goes blank, you don't have any questions anymore, right? Just you go in, you feel a bit stupid because you don't know why you're there anymore. And then you just enjoy the peace, right? You just sit down, enjoy the peace, do a bit of meditation, and you go again. You're just seeing somebody like that, just seeing the arahants of the world. I don't know if he was an arahant, but he obviously had something special. Just seeing that is very powerful because you're seeing something else, something very unusual. So this is what this is pointing you towards, you know, the power of these kind of things. So, friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. You gain confidence when you see something like this. And this is what inspires you. This is like the Sangha Nusati, right? Or the Buddha Nusati. You remember these kind of people who are very special. And then it gives a sense of confidence. One little point there, which is interesting, is that inspires confidence in every way. That phrase is Samanta Pasadika. And Samanta Pasadika is a word that was used later on to used as one of the works that were written by Buddhaghosa in Sri Lanka a long time after the Buddha. And that is probably taken from this particular sutta, that title for his book, Samanta Pasadika. Anyway, these, friends, are the five ways of removing resentment by means of which a bhikkhu can entirely remove resentment towards whomever it has arisen. So the whole world is included in these five categories. Everybody goes in here. So it means that we don't have any excuse, right, for having ill will or anger. So it's great not to have an excuse, because it means that if you have no excuse, it means that, okay, you've got to find a solution to your problems. You've got to find a solution to the difficult things that you have with other people, because you don't really have an excuse. It's great when that happens, because you are forced to look a little bit more deeply into these issues. Okay, so that is how to remove ill will and anger. So please reflect on that sutta. I should, maybe towards the end, I will just like to maybe add just a few other things which you don't find here, but how to deal with anger, which I have found useful in my own life. And one of the very general ways of dealing with anger is this, just the general idea that it doesn't work, right? If you get angry with somebody else, usually the reason we get angry is we think that it empowers us. You feel powerful, you get energy when you're angry, and you're going to find a solution to the problem by getting angry. But very, very rarely does anger actually lead to a solution. Usually anger leads to more problems, and it's not really the way to go, especially if you get angry at things you can't do anything about, right? Very often we get angry at all kind of stuff. You watch something on TV which is not reasonable, which is not fair, then you get upset. But what can you do about that situation anyway? Sometimes maybe the best thing you can do is give a bit of a donation towards somebody who is in a difficult situation, and that's really all you can do sometimes. So then when you remember that the vast majority of the time, anger is not going to help. It's not going to make an iota of difference. In fact, it's going to make the situation worse. Make that, think about that, reflect on that. Make that a truth which you carry around with you. And then when anger starts to rise, you say, no, it's not going to work. It's going to make the situation worse. Why am I getting angry? It doesn't make any sense. And you let it go straight away. But again, it's something you have to develop, right? If you get angry with somebody else, usually they get defensive. If you start arguing with them, and if they change their ways because you're angry, usually they might change their way just because they want to please you, because they don't want to have an argument, because they are defensive, whatever it is. It's not usually, they don't usually change because it is a positive kind of change, because they really understand what's going on. Usually it is because for a wrong reason, right? So it doesn't really work. It's not effective. So because of that, remember that very simple truth, that anger doesn't actually work usually. And another way which is can be useful to remember is, remember that when somebody does bad things to you, remember that it's not personal. It's not about you and them, right? It's not, they don't do something, they're not angry, they don't do bad things towards you because it's about you. It's about them. That's the reason they do bad things. They do bad things because of their background. They do bad things because of their perception. They do bad things because of all these conditioning elements that come around them. It's not about you personally, it's about them. So instead of making it a personal thing and thinking about it as you versus them or something like that, you turn the attention back on the person and realize they are the one who have a problem and not you. Unless they have a valid criticism of you, of course. If they have a valid criticism of you, then you know, it's good to change. But if it is just, if there's nothing there, instead of getting angry, remember, it's about them. It's their problem. It's nothing to do with you. It's not a personal thing. It is the way they are, the way they have been conditioned. And again, it takes away the edge, right? Very often, the reason why we get angry with other people, we get upset, is because it feels personal. It feels like they have done something towards us. There's an issue between them and us. And a lot of that personal feeling comes from this idea of an essence, the sense of a self, right, inside of us. Them against us, this sense of solidity inside. That's never the truth. The truth is always that it is about conditioning and how we have come to be into this state. Anyway, there's just a couple of additional thoughts on top of what has already been said here. A lot of the time the Buddha doesn't really say, he doesn't really give the means for how to overcome defilements. Very often he just says these defilements are, we need to overcome them, and very often it's up to us to find the means. And often that is very useful, because the means that are most powerful for us will often be a little bit personal. Okay, so that is how to overcome anger. And just very briefly on the very end of that, as I was saying at the beginning, when we overcome anger, we're moving into the territory of metta, of loving kindness. This is just, you know, we are overcoming anger and developing metta are two sides of the same coin. So let me just talk very briefly about developing metta, because you can't really separate these two issues. One of the things about developing metta is that metta, remember, often we sit down in meditation practice and we try to develop the beautiful perception of other people, and then we have good intentions towards others, and we try to wish them well, right? But remember that to be able to wish other people well in meditation, with your thinking mind, you first of all, we have to learn how to wish them well in daily life, how to wish them well through speech, how to wish them well through action. This is the first thing here. So, and this is one thing the Buddha says, how we should live the monastic life. In the monastic life, we should act with acts, words, and thoughts of loving kindness towards our fellow monastics. So the words and the deeds are the basic things. And once you are able to act with kindness, with loving kindness, with compassion in this way towards others, then the meditation starts to become possible. It has to begin with the basics, right? This is just like the gradual training we have been looking at. It starts off with the morality in action and words, and then it moves on to the morality of the mind. And metta, of course, is part of this. So it starts off with the metta, with the kindness in action and speech, and then you move on to the action, metta in thought afterwards. Then the meditation on metta becomes possible. So remember that. So this is like a a gradual development. You have to start in the place where it's possible to start. And then when you do that, when you act in this way and you come to the now you come on to the metta in metta meditation, now you have some idea what's happening. What is happening? The way that the metta meditation works, and the way, you know, when I start off metta meditation, I always say, well, remember the good qualities, right? Remember the spiritual qualities, whether it's in another person or just a group of people in a certain direction. Because it is by remembering the goodness in somebody else, by remembering the good qualities, that is what metta is about, right? So you have to focus on the goodness. When you focus on the bad parts, you get angry. When you focus on the good parts, you get metta. These are the two opposites. So you start off by remembering the good qualities. That's why many metta meditations that say you start off with the friendly person, right? The person you really like or you really respect because of the good qualities. The reason is because then you are focusing on good qualities. Don't have to do it that way. You can just think of all the people in the northern direction. Just remind yourself of all the good people out there and bring to mind all those good qualities. And when they become powerful, when you see that powerfully, then the metta for that person, for those people, for that direction becomes possible. So this is how you do it. That is why you have this famous simile of the saw in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is Majjhima Nikaya 21, the simile of the saw, the Kakkachupama Sutta. And in there it says that even if somebody saws you apart limb by limb, they take a two-handled saw and they saw you apart limb by limb, right? Still, you should have metta towards that person. That is just that, right? It's this ability to focus on the good in the person rather than focusing on the bad. You're able to, even though they saw you apart limb by limb, you're able to see if there is something good there, you can see that. Right? You can imagine, it's almost like, imagine that somebody saws somebody else up limb by limb, right? They're sitting in the corner over there sawing away. If it is somebody else, then it's easy to see, right? Yeah, okay, they're sawing that person, that's a bad act, but they also have some good qualities. So you have to kind of, it's almost like you have to depersonalize it a little bit. It's not about you, it's not about sawing apart your body, it's just about they are sawing apart, right? And that's a bad act. So you're able to kind of distance yourself, and even in that situation, you're able to see the good qualities. And what this means, that often when we do metta meditation, for it to be able to work, is that we have to resolve all of these problems that we have with other people, right? Some people are very good, they have very few problems with others, but sometimes there are maybe few individuals that we find very hard in this world. So you have to resolve that first of all. If metta is going to take off, you can't really have these blockages in the system. So you have to resolve those issues. So even the two-handed person who chops you apart with a two-handed saw, even there you have metta. Even the person who abuses you, you have a sense of metta, right? You remember, it's got nothing to do with you. It's not personal. Okay, you look at the good parts and you have metta instead. And that by doing this, by kind of resolving the places in life where we have issues with other people, when you resolve that, you are taking away the blockages that make metta possible. And that's why the Buddha would say, you start off the metta practice with the person that is difficult, right? If somebody is abusing you, you start off having the metta towards the person who is abusing you. If you don't have metta towards them, if you don't have compassion towards them, that's going to reverberate in the mind and going to stop you from being able to do this practice properly. So that is hard. So that is basically the way that the Buddha lays it down. If that doesn't work for you, if you find that it's too difficult, then you start off in different areas, and then you go back to the beautiful person, and then you move on in accordingly. It is really, it comes down to whatever works. That is basically the way this practice should be done. But ultimately, we have to remove those blockages. And then, when the blockages are removed, then we come to this last sutta, which is here. And this is just the standard way that metta is explained in the suttas. This is the simile of the cloth. This is the Vattupama Sutta, Majjhima number 7. And this is the standard expression of loving kindness, how to do the loving kindness meditation. And just very briefly, he abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, with metta. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around and everywhere, to all as to himself. He abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And then you have the same for compassion, for altruistic joy, and for equanimity afterwards. So you can see here the whole world is included, right? And that is why we need to undo those knots and problems, if there are any, so that there is no boundaries. There is no boundary between us and them. Metta is this kind of unified field that just goes out and out everywhere. No boundaries are left. This is kind of the ideal type of metta. And this is the way the Buddha always explains it in the suttas, always in the same way. And you can see here, there's not even any persons mentioned, right? Because, and the reason is that no person mentioned, because this is a boundless kind of metta. You just have it towards that direction, and you have it to the other direction, and you include yourself. Anyway, that's just very briefly on metta. But the main thing here is the idea of removing anger and removing resentment. And these things all go a part and parcel of the same practice.